and she's going to give a talk on pleiotropy and breeding on in flavor and vegetables. And I'll let you introduce yourself, Rosie.
Hello, Michael sends his regrets that he couldn't be here. He had a last-minute change of plans, so I am one of his PhD students filling in for him. So hopefully I do his talk justice. So I'm going to talk about pleiotropy in breeding for flavor in vegetables today. So a major question in plant breeding, especially as we start trying to think about sensory traits and quality traits, is how much flavor do we really have? There's always trade-offs with yield or with disease resistance. And so to what extent are we free to mix and match traits towards the creation of a new variety? And a main thing that causes this lack of freedom is linkage drag and pleiotropy. So linkage drag, as you know, is when two traits are closely linked genetically, so they tend to be inherited together unless a rare recombination event can split them up. But pleiotropy is even harder to deal with as a breeder because it's when one gene controls two or more traits, as you know. But we have found in our breeding program that pleiotropy can be either friend or foe, because if several positive traits are inherited together, then that makes it easier because we can manipulate those traits as a single unit. But if there is a positive and a negative trait inherited together, then we need to compromise because the good comes along with the bad. So I'm going to tell you three different stories about pleiotropy that we have encountered in our breeding program, and that is aroma and pungency in habanero, nutrition in hullet seeds and pumpkin, and fruit quality traits in butternut. So I know all of you have probably smelled a hot pepper. So that's a really complex, interesting aroma that we associate very closely with spiciness. But in fact, the spicy compounds, or the capsaicinoids, are odorless themselves. So it's just the different volatiles and aromas that make us think of something as spicy. So you had a really great introduction to this technology in the previous talk, better than I could do. And so what you're seeing here is a volatile analysis with gas chromatography separating the compounds along the x-axis over time. And then the peaks are mass spectrometry identified volatiles, and the blue arrows are where the experimenter identified odors as the compounds were separated over time. And as you see, again, as was mentioned, some of the peaks correspond with odors, such as the first one, number one, hexanal, that has a green grassy aroma. But the strongest habanero odor, peak number or number three there, did not have a detected volatile with it. So because there's this close association between capsaicinoids, or the spicy compounds, and that aroma, we wanted to see how closely they are actually associated in their production and localization in the pepper. So this top figure you just saw is the whole fruit volatile profile. And then we split it up into different parts. So we have the pericarp, which is the green, and the seeds. And those are parts of the pepper that do not accumulate capsaicinoids. And sure enough, they have much lower amounts of volatiles. So these are thousands on this y-axis here, as opposed to millions on the others. And it's different from the characteristic habanero whole fruit profile. But if you look at the placental decipiment, which is the white tissue here the seeds are attached to, and even more specifically, the swab of the blisters on the placental decipiment, which is where the capsaicinoids accumulate in oil droplets, they have very high levels of volatiles and in the characteristic pattern. So we found that volatiles do indeed co-accumulate in the fruit with capsaicinoids. And so to study this further, we harness the power of a gene that the lab has been working on for a long time, which is PUN1. And so you are all familiar with the effects of this gene because it's responsible for non-pungency in bell peppers. So here in Capsicum annuum, which is a species that bell peppers are a part of, there is a huge deletion that makes a total knockout of the gene. But in Capsicum chinense, which is a species that habanero is in, there is another allele of the gene, more recently detected, not commonly used in breeding, that just has this four base pair deletion, which makes it a little bit more interesting. So we looked at a PUN1-2 mutant and first compared its volatile profile to habanero, which is what you see up here. So it's very different, and again, you can see with the different y-axis, it's much lower levels of volatiles overall. And so we made an F2 population segregating for this gene, and then did a principal components analysis of the volatile profile. And you see here they grouped very nicely. So the ones circled in blue are the homozygous PUN1-2 mutants, and all the rest have at least one wild-type allele of PUN1. And so they also did a capsaicinoid spiciness assessment and smelled to assess for hot pepper aroma, and there was a perfect co-segregation between wild-type PUN1, wild-type volatiles, capsaicinoids, the presence of capsaicinoids, and a hot pepper aroma, suggesting that these suite of traits are pleiotropically controlled by the PUN1 gene. And this kind of reiterates what I just said. They co-accumulate, and they have a shared genetic control, and they also have a common pool of precursors that lead to the volatiles and the capsaicinoids and a similar biosynthesis. So this is an example of pleiotropy that became frustrating to us in the breeding program because, as you can imagine, it would be interesting to have a hot pepper with all of those good flavors and aromas, but that consumers can readily eat, unlike habaneros, which most of us can't just snack on. So we started to select for increased hot pepper aroma in the non-pungent background. So the mutant PUN1-2, which does not accumulate capsaicinoids in the blisters you see here, was back-crossed to habanero, and then in several generations was selected for hot pepper aroma. So we were able to find some peppers that make just a few little blisters. And so we think what's happening is by enriching for the high pungency QTLs in habanero, combined with that only 4 base pair frameshift mutation, we can occasionally get some reversions of that mutation back to the correct reading frame, and it's able to make enough of the volatiles and capsaicinoids for just a little bit of spiciness and a very detectable amount of aroma. So that pepper turned into our habanada pepper release, which is habanera without heat. So you can see them here. They do have a slightly different shape because we found that grocery stores were unwilling to take any chances with mix-ups between produce bins, but they're quite flavorful and have just barely perceptible heat, so they can be easily used as a snack pepper for cooking in large quantities. So now I'm going to shift to the second trait, which is the hullless seed trait, or the naked seeded trait. So that's found in pumpkins, mainly, in the species Cucurbita pepo, and it's a single gene recessive mutation in which the seed coat fails to fully develop and thicken, so it just has this little wispy reduced seed coat. And these are interesting because squash seed oil is a growing market in the United States. It's been a staple in Austria, especially for a long time, and as snack seeds is another use for a pumpkin crop. And so we found a couple different pleiotropic effects of this mutation in our breeding program. The first was really positive. So Nick Beeble is an undergrad in our lab who just finished his senior thesis working on this project, which is hullless seed nutrition. So the top one here, Lady Godiva, is a naked-seeded pumpkin, and Sweet Reba is a acorn squash with regular seeds. And you can see it has much higher tocopherols or vitamin E compounds, and also much higher carotenoids in the naked-seeded pumpkin seeds. So that's nice because it's a positive effect of selecting for this trait. But there is a negative aspect of this trait as well, and that is ease of seed production. So as you can imagine, when you greatly reduce the seed coat, the seeds become much more delicate, and they also tend to sprout within the pumpkin. So this is a pumpkin that I chopped open in the field and pulled these new plants out of it, which is not what you want if you're growing it as a seed crop, so you have to be really careful about the timing. But there is a little bit of flexibility in that there are some modifiers that control the degree of residual seed coat. So you see these seeds have a little bit more seed coat than these, so they are easier to work with but marginally less palatable and visually appealing. So what we've done is breed a zucchini now with hullus seeds, and previously this trait was mainly in oilseed pumpkins. And so we have a zucchini in trials this summer. that you can eat as a summer squash, and then once you get sick of your zucchini, you can grow them to maturity and eat the seeds instead. And so finally, I'm going to talk about fruit quality in winter squash. And we have had a lot of fun in our breeding program working with the squash honey nut, which you see here, which is a miniature butternut, and it has some really interesting flavor aspects that were crossed in from buttercup from the Cucurbita maxima species. And so the way we measure our fruit quality is with carotenoids, sweetness, and texture. So those are the easy things to measure as part of the breeding program. So carotenoids are important for color and visual appeal, as well as provitamin A and other nutrient compounds. Sweetness, higher sweetness is preferred by most consumers in squash and also has been found to make squash flavor more distinct. And the ideal texture is smooth and not watery, and that is positively correlated with starch and dry matter content. So we typically measure color, bricks, and dry matter. And what we found is they tend to be highly correlated within our breeding program. So this is a graph of bricks and percent dry matter in an F2 population between honey nut and another butternut of more typical fruit quality. And you can see that really strong positive correlation. So what we do now is, since we know this, and we have a lot of squash samples to process every fall, more and more every year it seems, we just select for bricks initially, and that we found that's a really good cutoff because squash generally aren't going to taste good if they don't have high enough bricks. And then we can do more refined selection in more advanced generations. And that's not to say that that is all you need to look at. We do go on to select for flavor with tasting panels, harnessing graduate student classes to do some tastings for us, and that is how we finally select our favorite squash for release. So those have been three snapshots of Pleiotropi in our breeding program, and one thing, since it has allowed us to make these new and interesting combinations, it's important to think about how to then successfully introduce them to the market, because these are not always traits that consumers are familiar with or comfortable with. So what we've been doing is have forged a successful partnership with chefs and culinary schools. So we can send them more advanced products. They will cook them, taste them, let us know what they think, give us suggestions for preparation. We've radically changed our squash preparation method for taste tests because it's much more aligned with how one might be cooking it at home, we hope. No microwaving squash. And we are also able to get feedback in earlier generations for things to look for. I have gone back to our archives and pulled out some things that we had initially discarded because it wasn't what the mainstream consumer normally wants. So that makes it really fun and exciting. And it also gets us some publicity of our releases ahead of time, which is great. So with that, I would like to acknowledge David Bollier from CalSec, who helped with the habanero work, Marianne and Michael, who are our fabulous technicians, and Nick Beeble, who did the pumpkin seed nutrition work as part of his senior honors thesis, and then all of our funding sources. Thank you.
We have a few minutes for questions.
On the habanero project, you have the four base pair mutation, which is producing some volatile, so you get aroma.
Mm-hmm.
You may have showed it, and I may have missed it, but how would you characterize the difference between the full aroma profile of a habanero and that mutation? Do you get, is there a proportional reduction? What is the difference?
Yeah, so the typical pepper with that mutation has a very reduced and different profile. So I think what happened is when it was selected for high throughput in the pathway to make more of the volatiles and capsaicinoids overall, you started getting some more of those typical volatiles made. So I didn't show that figure specifically. I'm not sure if Michael did that test when he did these experiments, but you could ask him.
Thank you.
One more question?
I think that it's kind of hard to make that assumption of Pleiotropi when you discount the effect of the environment. If you don't measure the environmental variation effect of genotype by environment interaction for those particular traits, because what we found in our peppers is that there's a bigger environmental effect on volatiles and capsaicin than sometimes the genetic effect. So I think that may be confounding some of the assumptions about pleiotropy, because going back in the literature, you can see they've had this discussion for 50 years about that.
Okay.
We found that the environment actually has a bigger impact. That's why you grow hatch chilies in hatch New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
and not in Florida, because yeah. in that environment they develop a great volatile profile.
Yep, I will mention that to him.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.